If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
People can change anything they want to. And that means everything in the world. Show me any country, and there'll be people in it. It's time to take the humanity back into the center of the ring and follow that for a time. You know, think on that. Without people, you're nothing. Without people, you're nothing.
Stoke the fire.
Jesse Leach, it's been a while, my friend. It has been a while.
Yeah, I miss it, man. It's good to be back here on here with you doing this. I definitely feel the lack of stoke the fire in my life.
Well, we need to stoke these flames, don't we? The fire's been dying, so we've got to get these twigs and we've got to rub them together with haste. This is, of course, the second episode in our all-new format of the podcast where it's audio only from here on in. We will be, however, putting the raw, unedited videos from the Zoom chats on our Patreon page. So yet another incentive to support the show via patreon.com/stokethefire. There is only one tier now, the final tier, if you will, $5 a month to stoke the flames. So yeah, if you want to support the show, if you want to get loads of extra stuff, that's all it costs. And there's already tons of stuff on there, loads of bonus podcasts, one-on-one chats with me and Jesse, listener episodes. Jesse's been on a bit of a hot streak as of late with just videos and spoken word poetry. And I love how creative you are, man. Like, your contributions to that page are so well received by everybody on there. And I just love seeing how excited everybody gets whenever you post stuff and you never tell me what you're going to do. So I don't know. I just see them arrive on there the same time as everybody else. And I'm like, oh, no way. He's at it again.
I even just put up a trip hop song recently, just whatever I'm feeling. You know, if I'm feeling something, I'll just put it on there. That's what that page is for. You know, if I'm feeling creative or whatever, I just drop it on there just because I'm so grateful for you guys for supporting us.
Hell yeah. And if you're not already, please do subscribe to the show as well, because at the moment, everything is a little bit irregular. And I'm guessing as we go into summer, things are going to be as, if not more irregular. We've got festival season coming up. Jesse's got a new album coming out. So please do get over to wherever you consume your podcast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. Hit follow or like or subscribe. And then that way, every time a new episode goes up, you'll be updated automatically to your device or smartphone, etc. So you can keep up that way. And obviously, you know, if you're not already, follow us on social media too, as we post about the episodes on there as and when they happen. I just posted a photo, a still from one of the TV shows, which today's guest acts in. Teasing this one because I'm always intrigued to know with a show, a film and series of shows like This Is England, how, you know, well known something so British as those amazing pieces of work are over in the US. But you're more than familiar with them, aren't you, Jesse? You, in fact, love them. And that was one of the very early things that you and I bonded over.
Yeah, it's something I'll definitely get into as we jump into the conversation. And it's a unique way that I got into it. So I'll explain that when we're in the conversation. Yeah.
But is it known? Is it something that's widely known, or is it more of like a cult underground? You got to be in the know in the States.
Yeah, I think it's definitely more of a culty thing than it is, you know, sort of something that, you know, people in the States talk about. But when you're in the know, there's a whole, like, the eyes light up and people are like, yes, like, it's a thing. It's definitely a thing for sure.
Well, without further ado, let's get the main man on the show. He's a good friend of mine. I got to see him just before Christmas at a gig and it was amazing. We, you know, had a great catch up there. That's the first time we'd hung out in person in a good few years. So, yeah, without further ado, Andy Ellis, actor, creative and fellow podcaster as well. Please flick on your camera and microphone, dude, and join us. Around the proverbial campfire. There he is. What's up, dude?
Hello, hello, hello. Hi, guys. Cheers for having us. Thanks for the kind words then. I was sat smiling to myself. Forgot the camera was off. I was like, oh. Yeah, there was no camera, but yeah.
Doing the
lovely
thumbs
kind
up.
Words.
So Jesse, Andy, Jesse.
Hi. Pleasure.
Hi.
Let's jump straight in then. Before we go way back and hear the timeline of your life, Andy, which is what we like to do here on the show, from birth to now.
Oh, wow.
Jesse, very quickly, why don't you shed some light on how you discovered and became aware of This Is England? Was it the film first for you or the TV show?
Yeah, film first. So I very much connected to ska and reggae culture, skinhead culture, you know, actual skinhead culture, and punk rock. It's at my roots. And I was on tour with my band, one of my bands called Times of Grace back in 2011. And our guy who was working with us was Lemmy from Motorhead's main assistant for 8 years. His name is Dan Halen. That's his road name. And we got on really well, really famously. And he's super into the same types of music I am. And a night we're out just having pints, hanging out. And he's like, "You ever watch This Is England?" And I'm like, "No, I have no idea what that is." So on that tour, back before, you know, this is back before, you know, Netflix and all that shit. We had hard drives where you'd plug your hard drive in your computer and steal a bunch of movies. So he gave me the movie and then the television series. And that entire tour, as soon as I had a moment off stage, out of the shower, have dinner, I'm back in my bunk in the bus watching, like, just
amazing, man.
Fucking obsessed with that show. And then the soundtrack to it. And then when I was finished with all of it, I rewatched it. Like, I just, it became a thing where it sounds funny, and I'm sure you've gotten this before, where I felt like you guys were my friends. Like, that show sucked me in so much that I just, like, wanted to live in it. I was like, these people, the way that this show makes me feel, is like I'm at home with my friends. So yeah, to this day. And I just been rewatching it recently because I knew we were going to have you on, and then listening to your podcast, which is something I'll definitely get into as well. There's a general feeling of just genuineness about you that I really love and can sort of relate to, because you're not, you know, one of those actors or one of those people in the industry that sort of puts on this persona. You just seem to be what you see is what you get. And that's really what I dig about you.
Oh, nice one, man. Yeah, I think that was always the kind of the way, obviously, Shane Meadows cast the film. You know, the majority of the cast weren't actors or were young, you know, working in like acting workshops and things like that. But nobody was like a trained professional actor or anything like that. You know, most of us were sort of school age at the time. And I guess that's, you know, that's the thing that kind of comes across again and again, people saying how authentic the friendship seems to be and stuff like that. And I think it genuinely is, because it is, you know, like, obviously myself and Thomas Turgoose have a podcast, and, you know, a lot of actors will say, "Oh yeah, you know, everybody keeps in touch and stuff like that." But we, you know, we genuinely do like that. This Is England. Obviously a lot of people are very busy, you know, even more so nowadays. But, you know, we've been speaking today in a WhatsApp group. One of the girls runs a dance school. We're going to go down there in Derby and teach the kids and stuff like that. So, like, we are, you know, quite close, really. That was my first job. But other jobs, you build very close friendships with people, and then you join, like, a WhatsApp group or whatever. And then after a couple of months, it kind of fades out. But, you know, the last time we filmed any sort of This Is England stuff was, you know, 8-9 years ago now. So it's still there, you know, that bond's still there after 9 years since we shot 90 anyway, you know.
Yeah, and 90 was an intense one, man. That was an intense one. Shit.
Yeah, do you have a WhatsApp group? This Is England WhatsApp group with all of you?
We do, yeah, we do.
Oh, mate, that's amazing.
Pretty much everyone's in there as well, I think. You know, obviously you've got like us young a lot, but then I think like every now and again Johnny Harris or someone will pop in and be like, "Sorry guys, I've not spoke," but we probably do his head in, do you know what I mean? When we get on a
bing, bing, bing. Rant.
Yeah.
That's amazing, dude. So where are you from? You're from a kind of like a small area just outside of Manchester, right?
A big area. I'm from it's a place called Wythenshaw. It was, I always say this, it was at one point the biggest council estate in the world.
Wow.
But now, because of politics and stuff, it's kind of owned by private companies and stuff. It's still a council estate, but it's owned by private entities and things like that. So great town. You know, yeah, I love being from here. I love Manchester, and yeah.
And so a council estate for people in America listening, I mean, would
yeah, me.
Does it just mean ghetto? Like, what would their equivalent be? Like, projects? Would it be projects, Jesse? Like housing projects?
Yeah, projects is the word for government-funded housing that allows people of low income to afford to live there. Yeah, projects.
Yeah, so, I suppose it's a very similar kind of thing. Obviously, you know, when this estate was built, like, luckily, you know, looking out my window now, it's a beautiful place. You know, it was built as a, I think they call it like a garden city. So every council house that was built had a garden front and back, or a yard front and back. It's very green. There's a lot of parks and stuff. So it's nice. But ultimately, like a lot of them places, you know, it has its very bad points, and has in the past, you know, had quite some dark days. But, you know, it's kind of up and coming a little bit now, you know, as a lot of places in the UK sort of currently are. It's a little bit kind of getting gentrified a bit and stuff like that now.
So you obviously love it enough to remain there, and you've got your own family now. You've got two kids. So have you always lived there despite whatever work you've had going on? Has that always been home base?
Yeah. Me and my wife, then girlfriend, we moved to London 2012. Yeah, because it was the Olympics year. We moved there 2012. We lasted like 9 months, 10 months, and we're like, wow. Nah. There's no the great thing about places like this, and I'm sure a lot of the places that Jesse will kind of know from the States is, you know, there's a great sense of community in these places. People, you know, there's bad apples everywhere, but, you know, genuinely a lot of people look out for each other. A lot of people, you know each other and stuff like that. And then when, you know, for me moving down south to London, it was such a culture shock in the sense of, like, there was none of that. There's no, you know, even with, you know, native Londoners, there's just no kind of sense of community or anything. People just don't talk to each other there. You know, us Northerners, we love to get on public transport and chat to each other and, you know, stuff like that, where that just doesn't happen down south.
Yeah, I got to say that Manchester is probably my favorite spot in England. You know, I obviously, being a musician, London was always the place we would go to. And then when we finally started playing in Manchester and had like a day off in Manchester, and I would go to, you know, on my day off, went to see a show in Manchester. It was like, I started to really understand that what you're talking about, that culture, it's completely different from London. That's like people talking about New York. You know, when you mention New York, people automatically think New York City. And I lived there for a while too, but now I moved up to Woodstock. I'm up in technically the country, up in the mountains. The community that's here is just everything I was missing so much. It's so isolating. It's funny, you're surrounded by all these people in a big city, but it can be very isolating for sure. So moving is huge. So I love to hear that you went back. That's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the main thing that kind of encouraged our move back was that kind of sense of community and stuff, because both me and my wife, you know, we love, you know, both our families are from this area. You know, we grew up around here, and all our friendship groups are predominantly around here. So there was none of that. You know, we both worked in London and stuff, but it's a big place. Everybody's scattered out and things like that, where, yeah, Manchester, even though it's a city, I think still retains a lot of that good stuff, like you were saying there, you know, a lot of that kind of sense of community, I think. And the north of England in general, you know, Liverpool has to be one of the, you know, best cities in my opinion, both, you know, for cultural, you know, music and things like that. And then again, that kind of sense of community that you find in them cities is just amazing. Yeah.
Jesse, why don't you tell Andy the story of your kind of memories of, was it Philadelphia?
Yeah, I'm one of the many places I lived in, but yeah, Philadelphia.
Where you had the drug dealer who was kind of looking out for your family because he respected your dad, because he was like, you know, the pasta guy. Because Andy's a huge, huge hip hop fan as well. So I'm sure you two will have a lot to talk about in regards
to. Oh, yeah.
Jesse was into the whole breakdancing scene and everything back in the day.
Oh, cool, man.
Yeah, they used to call me Little Man. So basically, my dad, through most of my life, was, you know, seeking God, and we would just uproot and leave places so he could study and earn his degrees and start churches. It was a whole crazy childhood that I, you know, that's a whole other story. But living in Philadelphia in the 1980s, when that explosion was happening, and as Matt mentioned, we lived in a predominantly poor, difficult, crime-ridden neighborhood, being the only white family too in a very black neighborhood. So back then in that era, there were radicalized groups that didn't really like the fact that we were living there. They wanted Whitey out. So our next door neighbor is an older lady named Mary, and her son was named Moses, biblical names. And Moses was a pimp.
And a
drug dealer, apparently. And he used to carry around a sawed off shotgun underneath his trench coat. And I just knew him as Uncle Moses. He would escort us around to the train stop, to the grocery store. Moses was around, but he was protecting my family.
Wow.
And down the street at the corner store there is the first time I saw breakdancing. And I used to go there all the time and watch as, like, you know, the early stuff, you know, the robotic sounding stuff like Houdini and, like, you know, when Beastie Boys were just coming out and Run DMC. Like, I was living through that as a little kid, 5-6 years old, watching that explosion happen. Unreal.
That's amazing. Yeah, it was honestly. I mean, you were saying earlier on, you know, how you connected with This Is England, and, you know, you'd have loved to kind of live that. You know, I was going to say, like, not many people want to live in the UK in the 1980s. It was very, but, you know, again, like, it was the same in the States with Reagan and, you know, Thatcher doing what they did, very similar kind of politics and stuff. But yeah, like that just fascinates me. Things like that, you know, that kind of birth of hip hop is just, yeah, incredible. And how that's like any music, really, how it spreads and catches the ears of, you know, I've always said this, like, I'm a white working class lad from the north of England, but my music taste is that of the same as you who lived there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it's that's the beautiful thing about music, I guess, that it can connect people right across the world who have no other sort of interests or social, you know, similarities. And yeah, amazing, man. Yes, that's
what's it's beautiful what culture can do, because I think that's what people miss when they talk about music, hip hop. And we can talk about, you know, the ska culture, the skinhead culture, the stuff that was in This Is England versus, you know, what hip hop was. It's really about the culture of working class. It's the culture of people who, I guess you could use the word, were less off, you know, were poor, were living check to check or living off government funding. So you have this desperation that was there, this tension. And I think because of that, and you can attest to the, I mean, we can all sort of attest to this growing up around it, is because of that, you band together as kids. You know, when I was a kid, we would go into, like, abandoned buildings and play hide and seek or make up games. And we had a bond that I don't think would have been there had we been in a upper class situation, had we been sort of well off where we had all kinds of toys and whatever. Like, we didn't have anything. So you go to the park and you grab a stick, and that stick becomes your toy for the day. And me and all my friends, we, like, just became what we thought we were. And it reminds me of that scene in This Is England where, you know, all the kids go into the field and they spend that day dressing up and just being kids, that beautiful moment that was captured there. So what was it like for you growing up in your neighborhood with the kids that you hung out with? What kind of stuff did you guys do to sort of occupy your time, or what kind of trouble did you get into?
Very, very similar sounding to yourself, really. You know, I mean, I was always lucky. Like, my mom and dad both, you know, worked very hard. So I was in no way kind of, you know, we were looked after, me, my sister and stuff, you know, not by any means like rich, but, you know, we had nice things. We, you know, went on holidays, vacations and stuff. But yeah, I mean, yeah, all sorts, really. I mean, I kind of grew up, I know, Matt, we've spoke about this a little bit before, because you're, like, quite friendly with the Dirty Sanchez boys. And, you know, I grew up on a diet of, like, Jackass, Dirty Sanchez. So, you know, when I got to, like, the age of, I don't know, 10, 11, you know, we were trying to skateboard. We were trying to you know, jump over each other and try, you know, intentionally hurting ourselves. But same thing, man. I mean, yeah, when you were saying there, like, you know, if there was a property that was being built nearby, we'd be in there. We'd be like, I remember we built a half pipe once, purely from stolen things from this like development of houses, and I still go past them houses now and look at it and I think, wow, what, like, what great days. But you know, again, playing a hide and seek, and we had a game, I don't know if there's like Manhunt, sort of similar to hide and seek,
just a bit more ominous.
Just a bit more ominous. But yeah, the same things, man. I grew up kind of, again, Wivenshaw being quite green as well as a council estate. My kind of parents' house sort of faced like this field that has like a little sort of stream running through. I mean, I paint a very nice picture of it there, but it's not. It was full of, like, if there wasn't a car on fire in it, or like litter or something, it was very, but we just used to, you know, climb trees and just, yeah, like you say, just entertaining yourself, really. You know, and then obviously, you know, again, kind of growing up in the 90s and early 2000s, obviously, you know, video games and things like that obviously start popping up and stuff. But yeah, man, so it seems like a very sort of similar thing. You know, you kind of create your own fun until your mum shouts you're in it at night to get ready for bed and school the next day, I guess.
Yeah, ours was the streetlights. If the streetlights came on, that was when my mother expected us to come back in. And then as you get older, you sort of disobey that and, you know, start to get into, you know, finding bottles of booze. And, you know, we used to do this thing in the States called Hey Buddy, where you'd go to a liquor store and you'd make friends with someone who was going in or out, and then offer money to get you your booze and stuff like that. And that's when that shit started happening. I no longer cared about the curfew, and I used to get in trouble a lot because of that.
Same here, man. I mean, I remember sort of later years of high school. So for over in the UK, that's like 15, 16.
Right.
I had a family member who, because Wivenshaw's right close by to Manchester Airport. And I had a family member that worked at the airport. And I don't know if I'm incriminating someone. The little kind of miniature
bottles. Just leave
the
name out.
The little miniature bottles of like alcohol.
Yeah, we call them
nips. You get on airplanes. So he'd have bags, and I mean like bin bags full of them. And I remember one day just sort of saying to him, I was like, can I take a few of them? And he was like, yeah, take what you want. Like I can get more. Like it was a constant flow. And I was like, all right, okay, cool. So I used to have this big Chicago Bulls coat, and it had like quite a load of like pockets. Again, massive hip hop child of the 90s, obviously.
I probably had the same coat as you, dude.
and it had some like inside pockets. But I remember cutting a little hole there, and I could fill this coat with like, I think I used to go out with about 50 of these little bottles to my local like local park and sell them for like a pound each. So
on
like
the
in my kind of, on the hustle. So in my later years of high school, on like a Friday and Saturday night, I was known as like the guy to go to. So we could bypass that kind of, because we used to do that as well, like waiting for people to go in the store for you. But obviously that's kind of a, you know, a risky game sometimes. But yeah, people just were like, Andy's in the park, I'm going to go and buy £5 worth of like hard liquor as well. Like it was, you know, it was vodka and all that and stuff. But yeah, and then in school, obviously, throughout that week, I was, you know, I was spending my dinner monies.
Living like a king.
I was probably doing better then than I am currently.
We had a good hustle going on, man. So when does the acting bug hit you? Is it a movie? Is it a TV show? Is it like a theater production you yourself get involved in? Like, when does that present itself as, you know, not even a career, but just something that you could see yourself falling in love with and getting into?
Yeah, so I had, again, I'm probably a little bit sort of younger than yourself, Jesse. You saying that you grew up in the 80s. I was born 1990. So a lot of my music taste and stuff I shouldn't have, really. It's kind of a bit of an older taste, but that's because I grew up with my older cousin, He's like 7 years older than me, so he'd probably be a sort of similar sort of age to yourself. And he got me into hip hop. He got me into, you know, all sorts of things. But one thing he got me into was like films. Good, like, you know, I mean, I remember being like 5 or 6 and watching, you know, things like Forrest Gump and just things that I shouldn't really be sort of watching at that time. Not in any, you know, not like grotesque horror films, but, you know,
you're not watching Irreversible or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, just, you know, cool sort of films of the day that I probably would have missed out on otherwise. And I just fell in love with that. And one of the things that he got me into was Friends. And again, I was probably too young to be watching it, but I remember just one night they did like a couple of episodes where they were in London. And he, I don't know if he bought, I think he had it and I kind of borrowed it and I've still got it. And this was nearly 30 years ago now, maybe. But he had like a book of all the behind the scenes stuff and stuff of that couple of episodes of Friends in London. And it had like scripts in there, like, you know, like the shooting scripts and stuff, like photocopies of that. And I just remember just reading it and just falling in love with that. And then when I got into high school, I had an interest in it. I was a very loud kid. I was the class clown and stuff like that. And then I remember there was a girl in the year above me who did dance and drama, and I didn't fancy dance. So I was like, I'm going to go and do drama because I need to like be in the same sort of environment as this girl. And then, yeah, fell in love with the drama, the acting side of things. Never got that girl, luckily, because now I've got a beautiful wife. But, you know, I followed it purely again because I want to be in that room, and then started to kind of just really enjoy it. And it was a great outlet for me because, as I say, you know, I was a very loud, very, you know, probably annoying to quite, well, definitely annoying to quite a few teachers kind of kid, because I was quite quick as well and quite smart. And then found acting and just loved it, really. I was then that kid who was sort of doing, you know, school plays and you know, drama club and things like that. And then kind of got a few of my mates involved because a few, you know, I was always kind of popular-ish. I was quite friendly with everyone because I was funny and stuff. A lot of my kind of like the kind of football lads, I'm sure, like the jocks, who I was quite pally with, I kind of dragged a few of them over because at first they were like, oh, it's for girls or whatever. And I'd always be like, well, who's your favorite actor? You know, and they'd come at you with like a Sylvester Stallone or something. You're like, well, you know, he's a red-blooded man, right? You know? dragged them over. Fell in love with it, really. It's just an outlet to be creative. And
I have the same story, really. My first love was theater. My uncle was a filmmaker, and I grew up, you know, in the 80s with such fun, good films.
Mm.
And I don't think I really knew who I was until I got into the Drama Kids, which is what we were called. Because through drama is where I discovered good music, like music that was not just the mainstream pop stuff. So theater was my gateway to do what I do. And, you know, my friends and we'd do the school plays, and then we would, you know, watch a movie and analyze it. Like The Breakfast Club was actually, our theater teacher made us watch The Breakfast Club and analyze that movie.
Oh, nice.
From the flaws to the continuity, so whatever. And then doing, you know, I forget the name of it, but essentially freestyle acting as exercises.
Like improv.
Improv. And yeah, man, I loved that shit. We used to all just smoke weed and do improv. And like, that's when I found my tribe, my people. So I love that. And what a great age to get into it too, because you really sort of, you have these bonds that you get with people when you do stuff like that, that sort of protect you from, you know, you said you got on pretty well with the jocks. I didn't. So I had my protection with the freaks and geeks and weirdos, and that was definitely all in drama.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like you say, I think, you know, my kind of getting on with them kind of guys was more because I could just make everyone kind of laugh. And that was it. And that was my protection, being a big lad. I've always been a big lad. So that obviously in earlier years, I'd get the comments, I'd get the bullying. And I quickly realized that, okay, if I can just make them laugh and kind of keep them kind of, you know, then they'll leave me alone and they'll go and, you know, deal with someone else. But yeah, exactly like you say, yeah, it's finding your tribe, you know, and especially like, you know, I think everybody pretty much has that like one teacher who you just always remember, who kind of helped you and stuff. And that was my drama teacher. Like, she was amazing. Like, I remember my first kind of time at drama club. And I was like, what, first year of high school, like 11. And she swore. And I was like, whoa. And I respected it because that's how people talk. That's how everybody I know, I grew up, like, you know, my parents, my grandparents, everybody swears in my real life, except these figures of authority, these teachers who kind of pretend. And that's one thing I've always hated, that kind of pretense of that people put on fronts. And I just remember she kind of swore, and I was just like, yeah, I love you. Like, you talk like me. Like, that's, you know.
What was the realities back then? And maybe you could shed some light on what it's like now as well for people coming from backgrounds and areas where you came from, trying to get into TV and film and professional acting, because the avenues are pretty slim, aren't they? And, you know, I mean, you obviously hit the jackpot with Shane and his, you know, his absolute attraction and fondness for that side of life, and you know, that's really where he sits and explores all in all his work, really. But, you know, now it seems like working class filmmakers, even let alone actors, there's not really an outlet for them. But when you were growing up, what was the avenue into, like, was there any sort of hope that you could do this as a job? Was there any like reality that could be a thing?
For me, like, again, you know, I wanted to be an actor, like in my head, going to drama club, and I was like, this is what I want to do. But, you know, again, growing up in a town where, you know, we've got a big hospital, we've got an industrial area, and we've got an airport. And like, if you don't go to one of them three things to work, you kind of, you're working a shop or whatever. You know, my school was great back in them days because we had a half decent government who kind of funded them a little bit better. And we had my school had like a speciality in performing arts. So they got like government money and built like a drama studio and a dance studio and stuff like that, which was, you know, looking back now, was like probably what kind of gave me that little bit of a nudge up. But for me, the only other person I could ever compare, there was a lad who was in, he was in a few years above me. Like, he kind of like left high school as I was coming into high school. And he was the lead role in a film called There's Only One Jimmy Grimble. Don't know if you remember it.
No.
It was basically, have you seen Like Mike?
Yeah.
With Lil Bow Wow. It was the same story. It was made a little bit before Like Mike. It's this lad from a council estate who ends up finding this pair of football boots, like soccer boots, and they belong to this Manchester City player from many years ago, and it makes the like magic boots, and they make him play really well. And the guy who was the main the lead in that, who played Jimmy Grimble, he was in my high school. Like I say, he kind of left as I was coming in, and I that was the only kind of reference I had to, oh, this could be a thing, this could be achievable, because his name's Lewis. Lewis has done it. And then, you know, but then still seeing the kind of realities of it. I remember one time, and I've told him this story a few times. I remember he was, because he kind of quit acting after that. But I remember seeing him cutting, like mowing my friend's neighbor's front garden. And I was like, "What? Why is Jimmy Grimble cutting next door's grass?" And my mate was like, "I don't know, he just don't do it anymore." So like, all, as well as having that kind of like, oh, someone's doing it, there was still that kind of like, someone's tried from here and hasn't quite done it. But I think, yeah, I think you're right, Matt. There was definitely a little bit more of a hope there, I think, for, you know, working class people to get into it. I think a lot of that kind of got took away in the past sort of 10 years or so, but it's kind of creeping back now. You know, for actors in the North, you kind of places to kind of cut your teeth in sort of TV and things like that were your things like, we have a TV show called Waterloo Road. It's set in like a high school. And that was great for kind of young, new, fresh actors coming in. And then that got axed and got taken away. So there was nothing really there. It's recently come back, which I think is great for young up and coming, you know, Northern actors. But yeah, I think nowadays it's a strange one, isn't it? For filmmakers and actors to kind of try and break into the industry at a time where you can easily be so creative because everybody's got a 4K camera pretty much in the pockets nowadays, you know? And I've always been a big advocate of that. Like, I remember watching when I filmed This Is England. I was 15, so I had to come back and do like the sort of last half of the year of high school, and I fell in love with obviously the acting side of it, but also watching Shane create, and I kind of came back going, I want to do that. Like, I want to make films. I want to explore that side of it as well, and then the same guy who got a lot of alcohol also got other things. And I remember like a little sort of, we got like a little.
He sounds like a good guy to know.
He's a great guy to know.
He's the guy. Yeah.
I got like a little mini, like a webcam kind of thing. And I think it held like probably not even, I don't know, probably about 60 megabytes of storage. And me and my friends made like a little short film on this, and we just got into it, you know, and got creative and flourished really. But I guess, yeah, like you're saying, going back to your question, like I sort of had that little leg up from the fact that my school had the facilities for that, because I know nowadays, you know, a lot of, you know, the education system isn't focusing on the arts at all, you know. It's kind of pushing, you know, things like maths and English, which are important, but I think music, art, like, you know, what's the point in being able to count to a billion if you can't, you know, do it while listening to your favorite music or, you know, watching your favorite show. Do you know what I mean? There's no life without art, and it boggles the mind why it's not funded properly. But, you know,
yeah, I think it's something that's taken for granted for sure by people. Film and music these days is just so accessible, and, you know, they have definitely reduced it in schools, which is definitely a shame. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So do you saying This Is England was your first ever gig, like first paid job?
Yeah. So So basically how I got into it. My school was used as like a set for this drama series that they were filming. It was just like a one-off little drama series. And it was shooting during the summer holidays. And they basically, they were shooting in a school, so they needed the school being populated with students. So they asked if any of the students wanted to be extras, background artists. So a lot of us were like, yeah, I think we got paid like £30 a day. And it was during the holidays anyway. So a few of us went to that, quite a lot of us went to that and did that and got an experience of being on set as a supporting artist. And then from that, like I said earlier, you know, I was the drama club guy and stuff like that. I think the producers of that were kind of like, okay, there's a source here, like an untapped source of kids who want to be in things. And they sent a few kind of audition things over. And one of them was this TV thing called Bulldogs, about skinheads in the 1980s. And then I went to the audition, and it turned out it was all kind of cloak and dagger, and it was a film, This Is England, although I think it was called Bulldog at the time. Auditioned for Shane. I think it was again in that sort of same kind of summer holiday period, and it was all the auditions and the film, etc., is very heavily improvised, which was something, again, Jesse, like, I loved in the drama, like just being able to be free and make things up. I ended up getting that part. I had to go away and do my first kind of, it was like the last year of high school. I had to go away to Nottingham for like 3 or 4 months and film This Is England and have a, you know, an amazing time for being such a young age.
Yeah, you're right on the cusp of your adolescence, aren't you? And what an amazing project to find yourself in, you know, because not only is it obviously an amazing piece of work and you got to work with beautiful and talented people, but you're actually making a film about what you yourself, not directly, of course, because you're not exposed to certain themes, but, you know, you're on the cusp of your adolescence, and the whole film really from your character's point of view is about exactly that.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
you can channel all your experience into this thing.
Yeah, it was, you know, again, I think that's, you know, the clever thing that Shane did. He did cast from, you know, council estates. He did cast from, like, Thomas Turgoose, you know, he was sort of street cast from a centre for kids that just give up on school, that have just gone, I'm not fit there. I don't fit there. So they go to this kind of centre. And I think that's just the genius of it, because then he gets real cheeky little shits.
Yeah,
what? I love what you want. I love the story about Thomas, obviously, which has been widely told, that he goes up and he's like, well, you got to pay me, you know, if I'm auditioning, you got to pay me. And he's like, give me a fiver. And Shane was just enamored with the cheek of the lad, wasn't he? He was like, that's my guy right there. How did you get on with him when you first met him? What was your initial exchange like?
So, again, I didn't know who anyone was, you know. I'd not seen any of Shane's stuff, because even here in the UK then, like, Shane's stuff up to that point was very kind of cult, you know. It was very, you had to be in that kind of club to know of Shane Meadows, and the people who did were like, you know, loved him, rightly so. But yeah, like I didn't know who anyone was in the room. I remember, so I went in. And I think part of the reason as well, I always kind of think that I sort of got the part in the same way that I think Shane saw that cheekiness in Tomo. I think he's just a genius, man. And I went to that audition, and again, like, it was the middle of like July or August, and I had like a Chicago Bulls jersey on, you know, probably a pair of Jordan, like stuff that's like cool now. But like, you know, in the early 2000s, I stuck out like a sore thumb. But that's just like how me and like a couple of my friends dressed, because we loved hip hop and we, you know, we loved all that. And I think Shane just spotted that and was like, oh, well, I'm making a film about subcultures, essentially. And this kid gets it, you know. But I remember I had to do an initial sort of improvisation with a couple of actors. And I was auditioning for the part of the bully at first, who later became Harvey in the series. And then I got asked to come back to then audition for Gadget that sort of same day. And when I went and like sort of was speaking to, because my mum took me to the audition, and she was like, oh, the cameraman said you were doing really well. And I was like, what cameraman? And she like pointed over, and I went, and it was the one person I did know who was in that room. And I went, That's Stephen Graham, that mum. That's not the cameraman. I've been acting with him. And she was like, oh, well, he's been singing your praises. But like, you know, again, we just didn't have a clue. You know, I remember when I got offered the part, my mum, we were like, well, what do we do now? Like, we got the call and it was like, we'd love you to be a part of the film. And then someone, I can't remember who, but someone was like, oh, well, you've got to have an agent. You're an actor. So my mum rang up an agency, like a local agency, and was like, oh, you know, my son would love representation. And they're on the phone going, yeah, okay. And then she was like, yeah, no, he's just got this part in a film. And they're like, okay. And what's the film? And my mum was like, it's someone called Shane Meadows. And they're like, okay, yeah, we can see him. We can see your son.
When's he free?
Yeah, when's he free for an initial meeting?
So you mentioned Stephen Graham, and I really think it's important for anyone who hasn't seen This Is England, which you need to see. But Stephen comes to mind, Joseph comes to mind, Vicky. These are all names of, like, to me, actors who are just incredible. And Stephen in particular, he made his character made me so uncomfortable when I first watched the movie. He nailed that part so well, to the point where if you know anything he's done before and then since then, it's unrecognizable to who he kind of is or the characters he's played. what was it like being around someone like him, for example, and having to act around him? And did he stay in character? Was there any method stuff going on? Was he chummy? Like, how did that work? Because his character in particular, I think, was kind of, he freaked me out, honestly.
Yeah. Steven is the most loveliest bloke in the world. He is honestly the nicest guy you'll ever meet. But yeah, obviously he any room that he walks into, like he's that's his room now. You know, he's just got that presence of a you know, an amazing actor and a really big presence. And yeah, I mean, it's weird in a way because he's not really overly method, Steven. And obviously my character's relationship with Combo is that of, I like him, you know, Gadget. Ultimately joins that gang because he's like, I like what you're saying. I think this is more fun. I'm sick of being bullied myself. I'm sick of people taking advantage. And this is obviously Gadget's thoughts. And, you know, it gets turned on to immigrants and stuff like that. And so I just remember having the best time on set with Steven and Tomo, because obviously Thomas Turgoose, I know like he looks about 10 in the movie.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But we're only like a school year apart, me and Tomo. Like we're not that, I think he's like 31 now, I'm 32. So we're quite similar in age. Obviously we look massively different on the film. So we just had a ball with him because we call him Granddad because he was just like that fun granddad that you got to kind of mess around with. But when those scenes, when he switches, like there's the scene.
His face, he embodies it. It's fucking crazy.
Yeah. And when he does that, when you're on set, you see that and it is terrifying. Like the scene where there's a couple of kids playing football. And he takes the ball of him and his line is something like, go home, mummy's cooking curry. He like, because just before that, you know, on camera, you know, we were all having a laugh and having fun. And I think in the scene, like we come over and we're kind of kicking the ball about a bit and then he just changes. And his ability to do that is like second to none. Like, you know, Steven is rightly so becoming that kind of sort of like leading man, but he is one of the best character actors. He just loves, he embodies. I was lucky enough to work with Steven again last year.
You just posted is so funny. Have you jumped
when I scared him?
And he just goes to punch you, doesn't he? He's like ready to go.
He went to punch me and realized and stopped. Yeah. And we had an in-depth conversation about that after.
You did.
But yeah, you know, I was lucky enough, obviously, you know, for an actor like Steven's again. Remained a great friend from all them years ago. You know, we shot the film in like 2005, and has remained a great friend. You know, I've watched his kids grow up, you know, and stuff like that. And to get the chance to work with him once is like the best thing in the world. But then to get the chance to work with him again, is just amazing. And that kind of difference, like I remember, like you say, like, I remember watching him as a kid, and all of us untrained and actors, we'd be running around, you know, off camera. And then as soon as they said go, we'd kind of whatever. But Steven would always, before any take, just sit and just focus himself. And at the time when I was a kid, I didn't know what that was. I didn't get it. I was like, what is he doing? But as I've got older and then, you know, getting the chance last year to work with him again as an adult, I got it. I was like, he's focusing himself. And that's what makes him great, because when you're on a film set, and I'm guessing it'll be the same when you're on a tour or whatever, there's so much external stuff going on. You've got, you know, on a film set, you've got people talking about a scene that's 5 days away. You've got someone asking you, what do you want for your lunch and all that kind of crazy stuff. And it's easy to forget that you just need to be in this place at this time right now. You know, if you're on stage, you just need to be on that stage performing to that crowd right now, not thinking about the gig in 3 weeks that, you know, that may or may not happen or whatever. And Steven, you know, so good at that, so good at just zoning in that focus, and it shows. And yeah, it's something that, again, watching as an adult, you go, that's one of the many things that projects him.
Yeah, I like how you mentioned, and I see this throughout your work, you mentioned humor as being your sort of protection. And I find that with, you know, watching the movie and the TV show, I think even too, is super important. I think for anyone who hasn't seen the TV show versus the movie, that comedy that your character brings. And then I think even, I would say, with Joseph's humor as well, there's different types of humor that's being used. But your character, to me, just brought this kind of joy to the scene more than any other character did. Did that come? I think that would just come natural to you, you know, the way you interact with your characters. How much of that was scripted? How much were you able to just be yourself in those moments? You know, I think of moments when you're wearing like the sweater and you've got the mustache and you're dating the older lady, and like the whole thing where it seems like people are constantly busting your balls, but you're taking it well, and it just feels natural. So was that just you sort of tapping into that's who you already are? Or how did that work?
A little bit, I guess. I think the kind of overarching theme for me for Gadget is he wants to be liked. He wants to be loved. I spoke with Shane loads about, and we do a lot of this because we get to bring a lot to our characters in terms of improvising and bringing, you know, finding backstory and stuff. There was always this thing that Gadget lived with his like grandma. And for some reason, there was no parents, which is the complete opposite to me. Like, I grew up with a very sort of stable family, mum and dad and stuff. And he just has always been the butt of everyone's jokes and stuff like that. And he meets this gang. We always envision, I think, Gadget meeting the Skinhead gang, you know, a year or so before Sean does. And he just wants to make them laugh. He just wants to be involved with something and be liked, you know. And then that was the kind of crux in the film, where here comes this new kid. Who the fuck? And he starts saying stuff, and it's like, whoa, no. You know, Gadget was happy being at the bottom of a pecking order. But someone else coming and straight away getting there, that doesn't happen. You know, I think that's it. You know, I think, again, the genius of Shane is he allows you to bring in characteristics of yourself. And again, going back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, Combo and Steven's performance, you know, a lot of that was Steven bringing. I remember there's it's been quite quoted quite often, like there was a point when Steven got offered the role that he rang Shane up terrified, because he rang Shane up and he was like, I need to tell you something. And Shane was like, what, mate, what's up? And Stephen was like, I know I don't look it, but I'm mixed race. And Shane was like, what? And Stephen was like, yeah, like I'm mixed race. Like, you don't want me playing this horrible racist person.
It's like and Caribbean like, heritage, right? Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And Shane was like, no, that adds so much, you know, and that's the genius of him. Same again with Joe, with Joe Gilgan, who you mentioned there, like him, he is again that kind of person that any room you're in with Joe Gilgan, that's Joe Gilgan's route. Like, he is so funny and so, you know, batshit is the only way to describe Joe Gilgan. And that's coming from a place of love. Like, he is just batshit. Like, whenever you're with him, you're having the best time. Because
he's kind of off grid as well, right? He's a bit of a mysterious sort of character, right? Is he a bit reclusive and kind of just...
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, like he's probably one of the people from the cast that we don't interact much with. But when you see him, he's like that kind of friend who, like, you know, I've got a friend who like left our school and moved to Wales, but he'll come back every now and again. And it's like he's never left. And that's what Joe's like. You know, you might not see him for years, but when you see him, it's like you've not spent 5 minutes apart. You know, and again, him bringing in the series and stuff, like, he's got a parrot at one point. And that's because Joe bought a parrot and just had this parrot was living with us. His name was Ian Green, named after Ian Brown, but because he was green. And just literally, like, just a great guy to be around. And he put that into Woody. I remember when we were, because I got cast early on in the film, and I had to go up and down to Nottingham quite a bit to workshop other actors. So we like workshopped another Sean, and then we workshopped like another Woody, and the other, it was like kind of between Joe Gilgan and this other guy. And I think Shane wasn't too sure what he wanted in this leader of the gang, because the other guy was very much hard ass, you don't mess with me kind of leader, authority. And then here comes Joe Gilgan, who just makes you happy, just makes you laugh. You want to be in his presence. You want to elevate him to leader because he's a great guy. And that's, you know, ultimately what Woody is, what Woody became. He is a leader because, not because he's the hardest one, or, you know, he's whatever, he's the one that everybody is okay with being the leader because they just love him, you know, so much.
And on the back of what we're talking about as far as comedy and your interactions and using humor, the one thing I really loved about the movie and the series is there's really touchy, hard subjects that are tackled between racism and abuse. And, you know, throughout the movie and the series, I feel like, you know, there are intense moments that happen. But I got to say, and this brought a depth to your character in the 90, the This Is England 90, where you, it's after the rave, the morning after the rave, and you're sitting on the grass. And I can't remember the character's name, but, you know, she had just, you know, had a rough moment. I don't want to give it away. If anyone who hasn't seen it, you must watch it. But I rewatched.
I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about that.
Oh my God. I rewatched just that scene last night, because I was just kind of doing a little character analyzation of some stuff you've done. And there I was, without even being immersed into the series at all, just watching that clip on YouTube, just tears streaming down my face watching this scene, because of the way you, it just felt fucking real. Like, I felt like I was watching my friends. Like, where did you tap into? Like, how did you tap in from being this goofy character, and sincere character, lovable character? But that moment on screen to me was that moment, sort of like when Jim Carrey does, you know, the Truman Show, and you see, or, you know, Eternal, what is it, The Spotless Mind? I can't think of that name.
Eternal
of the movie.
Sunshine. Yeah.
Yeah. So you see that moment of, like, he's not just a funny, sort of lovable guy. There's a dark depth and pain there. What, how did you tap into that? And I would say, to me, that showed your depth as an actor. And that scene to this day, out of that whole series, all the dark, crazy stuff that happened, I love that scene probably more than any of them, because it just feels fucking real.
Yeah, thank you, mate. That's beyond lovely. I think that so the way I've, again, always kind of seen This Is England, because I've grown up on it. I've grown up doing it. You know, we shot the film in 2005, and we shot 90 in 2014. So it was like 10 years. That was my adolescence. I spent my adolescence being Gadget, in a sense. Every few years we went and we did this. And for me, each one is sort of like a chapter of my adolescence. The film, obviously, I was a kid. We were just having fun and just being ignorant to stuff. And then 86, you know, we were at that age where we could go out and drink. We could go out and party, and we did that as a cast as well as doing that on screen. Like, we had a lot of fun days on that one. And then
you all living together for that one.
We all lived together in flats, yeah. And by the end of it, we all owed a fair chunk of money to put the flats back to how they were, because they were like brand new build. And we all bought like paintball guns and things like that. And awesome. Yeah, there was like a used car sales thing over the road. And yeah, a fair few of them got shot with paintball guns. and just having, again, just that kind of dicking about, you know, and stuff. And then 88 was a strange one for me and for Gadget, because there was a divide in the gang, and Shane intentionally kept members apart. Wow, none of us were allowed to see Joe Gilgan during filming. He was always taken away. Same with Vicky McClure, until we met again, and we had that reunion on screen. And then we can, because it kind of, he shoots a lot of it chronologically, which is unheard of in TV and film.
Is that the scene on the street, real quick, where you bump into each
other?
Yeah,
we're
in like that's an amazing scene.
Outdoor market. Honestly, yeah. That was the first time, and I'd been acting at that point probably about 10 years. And like I say, we were separated from Joe. None of us could see Joe. Me, Tomo, Michael Soccer, etc. We could do what we wanted when we were together. But we weren't allowed to go and play with Joe. We weren't allowed to go and play out with Joe, which is genuinely what it feels like, you know. And on that night when we had that scene, afterwards, like, it was just an emotional scene. And afterwards, Shane kind of came over and he was like, if you guys want to go out now, like, you can go out with Joe, go and have fun, like, that's fine, we've got that scene in the bag. And and everyone was like buzzing and whatnot, and I literally remember calling again my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, and just being like, I need you, I need to cuddle you, I need to, like, I felt it. It was the first time I'd ever felt it, whatever it is, that kind of realness. And it really affected me. It really got to me. And everyone else went and partied, and I just came back to Manchester from Sheffield and met up with my girlfriend and just had a cuddle, like, you know. And then 90 for me, and I think where what you were talking about comes from, during the filming of 90, so it was split up, the filming of 90, because we had like a whole seasons thing. Each episode was a different season, so filming was kind of, we did a block sort of late summer, and then we did a block like just before kind of Christmas, like early, no, after Christmas, sorry. So I think we started in like September for the first block, and we finished, I know the date that we finished on October the 4th. And then we went back after Christmas, and I know the date because my first daughter was born on October the 5th. And
wow.
My kind of thinking of Gadget at this point, because I was growing up, I was about to, you know, become a grown up, the most ultimate becoming a grown up of things you can do, is I remember saying to Shane, like, even though he loves Kelly and has a romantic interest there, more than anything, he can put that in a shoebox here. He just wants to look after her. And when I'm in my head, I remember, like, I was literally channeling that fact, because we shot them scenes, which I've got a funny story about, but we shot them scenes like October the 3rd. Like, there was a point where I think my little girl was due on like September the 28th. And filming kind of went over, and I was like 2 or 3 hours away from my wife, and everything was obviously on a knife edge. And I just remember, yeah, trying to channel that kind of, like, I'm about to become someone's, you know, carer, someone's everything, you know, and I'm going to try and put that into how much Gadget wants to care for Kelly. So yeah, it's nice to know that it came through.
No, it didn't. And even the fight scene that you have with Michael's character, is it Michael?
Yeah, Harvey. Yeah, Michael's okay. Yeah.
That fight scene even is just intense, because it's like friendship and like, you see the darker side of it, and the anger, and then your frustration in your character. Just, yeah, brilliant, man. And I like how you said that about Woody too. I actually got like sick to my stomach during when you guys like split. I was like, no,
it's like mom and dad fighting. It was
crazy,
horrible.
Though, because I really think it speaks volumes of the accuracy and the genuineness of that, where, like, you know, the small circle of people I know that have seen those films and the TV shows, it's like borderline obsession for a while for a lot of people, because it just I don't know. I can't really put it into words. It's just something that has been a part of my life, especially when you're on the road and you're lonely, you're missing home, and you put that on, you connect. It's like, that's, I think, a true testament to the performances on that. Just incredible. And to hear that backstory, that makes a lot of sense. I can't imagine what that was like.
It was crazy, man. It was like you say, it's, and that's what you do as an actor. I think you try and channel, you want it to be real. You need to find a way to make it real. No matter, you know, I've never had a friend, luckily, who's been, you know, what she went through and become a heroin addict and things like that. So how do I make that real? How do I, you know, and then I'm going, well, I need to worry about her like I would worry about this child that's about to come into the, you know. It's not great. It definitely messes around with the old mental health sometimes. But I think that's something I've probably learned off people like Stephen. You know, you need to make it real. Don't just say it because it's written down. Find a way to make that sound real, you know, make people feel it. And that's, you know, what we're kind of here to do, I guess, as actors.
So do you, but yeah, you get that scene in the can, mate, and then literally go to the hospital to be there for the birth of your first kid? Like, is that just a 24-hour?
Much, yeah. So crazily enough, my wife was due on the 28th of September, and I, from that day on, I'm like, I've got to be going at any minute now, and everything was, and we, you know, awkwardly enough, that kind of week's block was that festival sort of thing that we're filming in that field where, you know, a lot of them people, them SAs, the casting had not casted like SAs. They'd gone and they'd found like pagans. They'd gone and they'd found people who live in their kind of vans that they've, you know.
Like travellers, essentially, right?
Travellers and just people like, not travellers in the sense of like, traveling community. There was a few sort of people from the traveling community there, but people who like, just again, like you were saying, sort of like the fringe of society, the freaks and the geeks, and populated, rather than populating it with actors background artists pretending to be that, Castine and Shane were like, no, we want everyone to have the gang to have this experience of being at this like eye-opening festival or whatever it was, so let's do it, let's go and do that. And you know, we did, the way that Shane shot that, he had like, I think we had about 5 or 6 cameras sort of roving around. The crew were kind of dressed up so that if they got caught you wouldn't really notice it. And Shane basically, so because that was like a night shoot, and obviously all that day we knew that we were going to go and do this like party scene, so we reverted back to like what you were saying before, Jesse, like that kind of like, you know, when you used to go to the park or whatever as a kid, and it was like, should we drink? And obviously, because we were professionals as well, but we were like, we need a little bit of a drink just to kind of get in the spirit. And a few of us went to the shop and did that old thing where you'd kind of get a bottle of Fanta, pour half of it away, fill the rest with vodka. Nobody will know. You can't smell vodka, apparently. And we were all like heading down to this party thing. Like I say, the shooting probably started at about like 9 p.m. because it was summer, so you get them long hours. And we were all like a little bit tipsy. And Shane just turned around to us before we started. And he went, have any of you had a drink? And we were all like, no, no, no. And he went, on his radio, went, can we get the cast some beers? Like, they need to be drinking, man. And we all just went, Shane, we're pretty drunk, man. And he went, yeah, carry on. So we had we had this crazy intense, like, we had that experience, you know, it wasn't fake. I went and got my cards read by some lady, and again, had this weird experience where, you know, she was flipping over tarot cards and going like, you know, your life is about to change. I can sense that. And I was like, shit, yeah, like I'm about to be a dad. But yeah, like, so we had that kind of, that shoot around that time. And then, yeah, I got home on like I say, the 4th of October, very, you know, tired, very hungover. And then early hours of like that morning, my wife then went into labor. It was like, wow, the baby must have known. Yeah, it was pretty surreal, really.
What a beautiful story. That's amazing, man. What a moment in your life.
Yeah, it starts with alcohol and ends with
with fatherhood.
As all good white stands do, right?
probably just going to say, probably, yeah, yeah. Recurring theme.
Hey, listen, I want to get into this real quick before we chat about your awesome podcast. So, Jesse, I had Gadget on my show a few years back. And so
I know.
I don't know if you know this, but the lady that he has the romantic affair with, Trudy, is actually Stephen Graham's real life wife.
Yeah, Hannah, yeah.
Oh, my God. No, Hannah. I did know that. I did know that. Yeah, I did know that, which is crazy.
It is. And going back to that kind of thing, like you were saying, where is it scary when Stephen changes on set? It's even more scarier 10 minutes before you're about to do a sort of semi-naked scene with his wife. He calls you up. You see Stephen Graham flash up. You answer it. And he's like, don't be fucking looking where you don't need to be looking, lad, right? And I'm like, obviously winding up, but genuinely meant it.
Oh, my God.
Keep your eyes up.
Fucking brilliant, man. She's amazing. His wife, you know, they always say, brilliant. Like, behind every great man is a great woman. And, you know, she is not only an amazing actor, but just an amazing human being. Like, when I went and spent the day at their house, her energy and her just aura, she's such a positive, beautiful, wonderful, wonderful human being, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. And you know, again, it's no secret. I know Stephen spoke about it before. Like, you know, Hannah very much reads every script and sort of guides Stephen. And Jesus Christ, she's doing a great job. You know, she's you know, just yeah. And she's an incredible actor as well. You know, and to work with her as a comedy actor, she's amazing. You know, as a dramatic actor, she's amazing. She's incredible. I love Hannah and Steve. They're great power couple.
It's amazing. I mean, just what a blessed experience. And I think what TV offers that film doesn't is, you know, you get to not only evolve and develop the characters over so many years, but you get to evolve these friendships, which usually when you do a film, it's, you know, maybe a year at the most.
With
what you've had, you know, there's a couple of other rare instances, like, say, a Game of Thrones or, you know, a show that goes on, but it's nowhere near as intimate. I think what you had with that whole This Is England project from start to end was so unique and so special. And I remember seeing all the pictures of all of you at Thomas's wedding on New Year's a couple of years back, and, you know, just all the cast there. And like those ties, those bonds, it's, you know, Jesse can relate. It's like being in a band, but the band is like twice the size of Slipknot. and you're all best mates.
Beautiful. Yeah, and probably more functional too.
Yeah.
I don't know. We've had our time. But again, I think, you know, This Is England was always meant to be just a film. It was always meant to be this one little project. And the fact that it became a TV series was exactly that, you know. Sadly, a couple of months after we shot the film, Tomo lost his mum, Sharon, and we all turned up. We all got in a minibus from Nottingham, went to her funeral and supported him. And Shane said a few times it was kind of on that minibus where he was like, I can't let these guys not carry on for a little bit, because we did become, like you say, it was very different. A lot, and it, you know, to a lot of jobs I've done, to a lot of jobs that I know other people have done, you know, that wouldn't happen. You know, we went there not because, you know, nobody knew who we were at that point. The film wasn't out or anything like, it wasn't like a, you know, anything like that. We went there because we loved Tomo and we loved his mum. She was on set quite a lot, and we loved each other. And I think Shane's seen that and was like, there's more stories to be told here with these guys, you know. So Yeah, it's strange. It is a strange relationship that we all have. We are a family, you know what I mean? Tomo was one of my groomsmen at when I got married. Didn't return the favour with me at his wedding, but I was there. It was nice. He had an hypnotist.
How beautiful that out of something so sad and tragic came, you know, something that touched the world in so many ways.
Yeah, man. And Sharon was great. She you know, I remember sort of at base when we were shooting the film, her seeing some of the rushes. Someone had edited a few. It was the kind of hunting scene where we're all dressed up and a few other ones. had edited them together as kind of rushes for Shane to watch. And I remember kind of watching it with her and Tomo, and just seeing her face as she's, you know, seeing this son doing something that, again, you know, the place where Tomo's from, you know, not a lot of people do that kind of stuff. So yeah, it was amazing, man. It was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's why though, I think, you know, I can speak from my, because I watch films and TV shows all the time when I'm on the tour bus. That's my way to decompress. That's my way to escape. You know, if I don't want to go out and party and drink, I want to take care of myself, I'm in my bunk watching films. Mm. Matt and I talk about films a lot. And I think that's why that series, above a lot of things that I've watched, and I, you know, I've gotten attached to a bunch of little series, and you become obsessed and you rewatch them. Like, you know, for me, it's like the Mighty Boosh is another British television that I'm obsessed with. I watch over and over again. I feel like they're my friends. But I think it's because there was so much realness going on between all of you that chemistry you can't duplicate that with just actors who are professionals who are told to do a certain thing and are masters of their craft. It would be good, but it wouldn't be the same thing. I think that comes through on the screen. And then, as a nice segue into your podcast, listening to your podcast is the same thing. I feel like I get to hang out with you and Thomas. Oh, and then, nice. You know, you talking about stuff with This Is England, talking about your real life, and it all kind of comes together. You know, I was in the kitchen yesterday making dinner for my lady, and just had your podcast on, and I'm just there chuckling. And then I'm like thinking about these things I hadn't thought about. And you're talking about, you know, going to the spa and people.
Oh,
like,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm loving it. I'm like, why have I not listened to this podcast? It's so fucking good. Cause it's just you guys hanging out, but it's so good. There's the chemistry is still there with that podcast.
But I mean, that's the thing. Like, it's, I guess it is chemistry. I love Thomas. Like, I do genuinely see him as, it's weird calling him Thomas. I do genuinely love him like a brother, you know what I mean? And I know he the same with me. And, you know, the podcast came from the fact that we were out drinking one time, and I think we were DJing, and we were just, and I loved podcasts at the time. It was like kind of 2018-19. I was listening to a lot, and I was like, oh, I'd love to do this. And I'm not a big soccer fan, and like, that's like heresy. Being British, being a Mancunian, and not being a soccer fan is like, and calling it soccer.
Yeah.
But you know, that's like heresy. And I remember sort of me and Tomo got onto the kind of, you know, chat about football or something. And I was like, I just find it very overrated, man. I just don't get, I understand, I'll watch the odd game and I'll be like, oh, that was fun. But like, people devoting their lives to it, people fighting each other for it, people like, you know, not letting, like, my dad is very much a big one of them people. And like, he's a Manchester City fan. Like, growing up, we weren't allowed red cars. We weren't allowed, like, someone
because
could go,
of United.
He's a red car for free. And he would be like, no, not driving a red car. You know, we weren't allowed. I'm a Manchester United fan, in, you know, quotation marks.
Oh, I bet that
probably just to annoy my dad. I think it did. I think it was probably just to annoy him. And again, growing up in the 90s, you're going to go Manchester United over Manchester City. It's, you know, again, it was a global brand, in the same way, like, I'm a Chicago Bulls fan. I've not watched much, you know, but yeah, and it just kind of came from that. Like, I was sort of like, you know, I just don't find it. It's just overrated. I think it's, and we were chatting about it, and I was like, there's the podcast, man. Like, let's just get people on to moan, because, you know, we all love to kind of bitch and moan about stuff, about something that everybody else seems to get, that they're just like, I don't get where the love of this comes from. And it's great, you know, and you know, thank you again for the lovely words, Jesse. But yeah, like, that's one of the kind of comments that people put a lot of the time. They're like, it feels like I'm in the pub with you guys just chatting. And that's the kind of vibe that we want. You know, there's a lot of great podcasts out there, you know, this one included, that all do, you know, things differently and do them well. And we're not, me and Tomo aren't, presenters or hosts. You know, we don't want to sit and kind of interview people. We do a little bit of that, like we chat about work and stuff if it comes along, but we just want to, yeah, we just want to riff on summit. And the overrated thing is, if anything, it's just an icebreaker, because, you know, Michael Soccer, for instance, the podcast that he just mentioned, he comes on and his subject is spa days. But we only probably speak about upspeak, yeah, which I feel like I might have done quite a bit on this podcast.
I love it. So funny.
it's probably only spoken about for like a small percentage of it. And then we'll just chat about whatever, you know, kind of comes along, really. But it's good fun, man. I just enjoy, you know, we did a lot of these kind of podcast sort of scenarios through COVID. And we did a whole series where we were behind laptops, hiding away from COVID and stuff, as a lot of people did. And that's amazing. And the guests that we were getting through that, like, you know, we were getting people on that we could never dream of getting on because of schedules and stuff. But everyone was sat at home doing the same thing, so it was great. But we were really itching to get back just meeting people, because, again, we love chatting. And we want to be there. We want to be meeting these people and, you know, being there in the flesh.
Nothing beats it, man. Like, obviously, me and Jesse are in different countries. So
yeah, it's hard to do.
By that nature, we have to do it this way. But, you know, with my show, like before COVID, I would do all of them in person. And you can't beat that energy that you have in the room when you're together. You know, it's just that much more intimate and exciting, and especially, you know, with what you do with Thomas, I imagine it's an excuse for the pair of you to go on road trips and hang out, and that's a big part of the whole draw. Like with me and Jesse doing this show, a big part of it is getting to hang out with each other, and I love that about having a co-host, is it's like, oh, I'm gonna get to see my mate today.
Yeah, like it's great. Like, you know, for this series that we're doing now, and very much series one, because series one we were just hitting the road and trying to get to people, and that creates it. So that's great, but then it kind of creates its own problems. You know, it's fine if you're sort of asking Stephen, who we know, if we can come around his house and record a podcast. But I remember speaking to like a comedian called James Acaster, and he was like, well, really up for it. And then I was like, but we, you know, we come around your house and we record it. And he was like, oh, I don't know, actually. And fair play. Like, I'd be a bit like, oh, okay, that's a bit strange. I don't know you.
Thomas did that with me. I came up to Grimsby to record with him. And he was like, I don't really want you coming around my house. Can we do it in my car? And I was like, absolutely, I remember that's fine. So we went out for fish and chips. And then we just sat in his car, baking hot day, sweating balls, and had a great chat. But, you know, again, you understand it, don't you? You've got to respect it.
So what we've done with series three is, you know, I've got like a production company, and I was like, let's merge the two. Like me and Tomo were really itching to get the podcast going again, but doing it properly this time and getting it filmed, and you know, we had a few issues with them early episodes with the audio, but we're kind of working through them now. But just getting it done a little bit proper and giving it a good go this time, because it's hard, you know, like work gets in the way sometimes, life gets in the way, and that's one of the downsides, I guess, of having a co-host, is if it's just your schedule, you kind of can work it, but then when you've got, you know, Thomas Turgoose, bloody voice of Sky, you're like, you're not free, are you, Tomo? You're advertising Sky Broadband or whatever.
Well, he's obviously recently become a parent as well. I guess recently, a couple of years now. So you're both dads as well.
Exactly. So there's real life as well as, you know, if we get a job. And that's what kind of stopped us doing the first series. Like, we both got jobs. And then the second series, we were doing it through COVID and we would have carried on. But it was at that point where it was enjoyable. And then it just became everything that we were doing, and we were like, oh, we're not spending time, obviously no one was spending time together, but we're not like just chatting as friends, we're only meeting up to do this. And it felt, you know, where now again it's nice, because how we're kind of doing it is Tomo will come to Manchester, we'll shoot a day in the studio, he'll then like stay over at my house. Like last time he came, like my little girl's just started to dabble with acting, and we helped her with a self tape, and that was amazing, man, for her to be like Tomo helping with a self tape.
That's the stuff of life right there, dude. What a beautiful full circle moment.
Yeah, it was great. And then we went to the pub, and then we got up and did it again the next day. You know, it's nice. It's an excuse to see each other and get drunk more than anything.
Well, I love that. And I think that, you know, in the world of podcasts, you know, you mentioned how every podcast is different. And I think the same thing with music, you know, like you're in a certain type of mood, you want to hear a certain type of podcast. And what I love about yours is, you know, I'm making dinner, I'm kicking about in the kitchen, just doing nothing. And I have it on and it feels like I'm hanging out or at the pub. And I think that that is great because, you know, I've got different moods for different podcasts. I listen to tons of different podcasts, but now I know like yours sits right. It's like, I don't have to think too much about it. I can have a laugh. I can maybe think about some stuff, but it's not intense, you know, because I listen to some stuff that's like intense, whether it be crime or like cryptozoology or aliens or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I love that about your podcast. It's something that it's just, it's almost like a cozy thing, just like being around with your pals in a pub. Love it. I think it's great.
Yeah, that's the ethos, man. And it's, you know, it's hopefully working.
I think it's great. You've got some great episodes already. I loved the Shea Meadows one because you don't hear him on a lot of podcasts or indeed any. So that one was amazing. The Stephen one was amazing. Him going in on fine dining. And talking about having to borrow the blazer from the waiter. Like, just fucking hilarious stuff, man.
So my favorite thing from that one was, again, this was the beauty of going to people's houses. Halfway through, he forgets the answer to something and just starts going, Hannah! What was that name? Or whatever. And, and you're like, this is brilliant because you wouldn't get this in a studio. He can't.
No. Oh, dude, yeah. The one I did round his house, he goes up to turn the washing machine off part of the way through. And I had that actor, Rich Brake, if you know him, he's in a lot of the Rob Zombie films.
Oh, yeah.
So I'd messaged him and been like, do you want to come on my show? Here's he's been on. And he said the thing that made him want to say yes is he listened to the Stephen Graham episode. And he's like, I just love the way you're in his kitchen. And he's fucking going in like the pantry to turn off the washing machine. And Hannah comes in again halfway through. And she's like, I love, like, it's just they're beautiful moments like that. And I always keep that stuff in. Like, I never edit anything out of any of my shows that I do. I want it to be as accurate and real and transparent as it can be. And yeah, man, you guys are onto a good thing. So can you tease any upcoming guests with us?
So yeah, next week's guest is a good one. We've got a few. We've got some hopefully booked in. We might have Maxine Peake booked in. I'm gonna say that now in hopes that somehow she hears this or someone gives her a nudge. I'd love, like, I'm a massive sort of lefty. And I know Maxine's like a big sort of socialist and stuff, and
she's just, from Manchester, right?
She's from Manchester again. You know, working class girl, and I love her every. You know, again from Dinner Ladies. This might all go over your head, Jesse, but there's a brilliant series with the late comedian Victoria Wood, called Dinner Ladies, and it's about lunch ladies in a school cafeteria, And at the time, like, Maxine's character was the big girl, you know, the funny big one. And I related to that as a kid. And yeah, I'd love to have her on. We've got Sam Bottomley on the next episode, who's just been nominated for Best Supporting Actor at the BAFTAs. So that's going to be exciting.
Dude, I'll tell you who I think is fucking amazing is that guy, Barry Keogh. He is killing it at the moment. His performance in The Banshees of Inisherin, or however you pronounce it, is one of the best, you know, performances from a young actor I've seen in several years.
Yeah, the moment where
everything he's been in is just, he's incredible. He's like pretty method, isn't he? Like Dustin Hoffman style.
I think so, yeah. I mean, the moment where he stood around that lake and he's sort of asking the lady out, and as soon as she rejects him, there's something in his face, in you, that goes, he's not going to handle that well. And then I don't want to do any spoilers, but he's amazing. I'd love to have him on. And again, he's from, you know, I know I've read things where I think he grew up in care, didn't he? And stuff like that. So
an orphan kid. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Such a, and just applied for a job in a newspaper, an acting job. And now, you know, amazing, man. Such a great story. And
what's
I want to
name
know
of that
what
film
ate.
Again? What's the name of that film?
Of Inisherin.
It's the new
on like Disney Plus.
What's the director called? He's done like Seven Psychopaths, Jesse,
he did,
and
In Bruges, didn't he?
In Bruges.
It's the same.
All his films are amazing.
Is his name gone out of my head, yeah.
Martin something, I think it is. But I'll send you a list of his films, Jesse. It's fucking
yeah.
amazing.
I'd love to have some new stuff to binge on.
It's very good. It's very I'm like of Irish descent, and it's very Irish, and really, you know, the jokes are just so, when they land so perfectly well. But then the drama is amazing as well. Yeah, great film.
I love it. I'm into it.
Well, dude, I guess we better let you go because it's tapping into your Friday evening. No doubt you'll be getting the dinner on soon.
I've got a night off tonight of the children.
Have you?
So,
amazing.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
What are you up to
my
then?
My mum's got them. We're just, I mean, my wife's, we're due our third in July. Yeah, so nothing crazy. No, you know, we'd normally, you know, go and, you know, paint the town. I'm just going to, yeah, we might just get a takeaway. And hopefully she's got a series to binge, and I'm going to probably jump on the Xbox for a bit.
Love it, mate. Amazing, dude. Well, dude, I'm so happy for everything that you have in your life. You know, you're just such a positive and lovely dude.
Oh,
I'm really
you,
grateful
mate.
That we're friends. And, you know, I always enjoy seeing you. It was great seeing you just before Christmas at that gig in Birmingham.
It was
good
a good
times.
Night. Yeah,
it was, wasn't
night,
it? Yeah. Larry
yeah.
Crowds. Jesse,
it was a crazy crowd.
He went out to like tell the crowds he's going to be DJing an after party after the show, and they were just chanting over everything he was saying. So, so he just goes, fucking animals, flips them off. And
love it.
So good. But yeah, it's always a pleasure, Andy. Always a pleasure, mate. And
thanks for having us, guys. It was lovely to be back on, Matt, and lovely to meet Jesse, man. Yeah.
Yeah, it was honestly a bigger honor than I'll lead on. I was sort of holding back my fanboyism, but it just what the work you've done really affected me on a deep level. It comforted me. It gave me a sense of again having friends in a dark, there's a backstory to this, but it was a very dark time in my life. So This Is England will stand forever as one of my favorite things. And I would say the next time I'm over the UK, if I have any free time, love to meet at a pub, listen to some hip hop music, like whatever. Just be regular guys, you and Tomo or whatever, whoever is in the area. But Matt and I are overdue for something. So at some point when the schedule allows, you know, we definitely want to meet and hang out in person. And if we ever 100%. If we ever do in-person podcasting over in the UK, you got to be part of it.
Oh, mate, yeah, I'd love to be. I'd love to be. And going off what you said there about, you know, watching This Is England in a dark time, man, like that makes it worth it. Like, do you know what I mean? What I do, I love, you know, that's what, you know, makes it worth it, man. Thank you for, you know, thank you. I've really enjoyed this. I've really enjoyed this.
Right on, brother. And I'll be listening to your podcast, man. Stoked
Cheers,
for that.
Dude. Cheers. Thank you. And I'll
All
listen
right,
to
brother.
This.
Yeah, overrated everything. Guys. We'll link it up. We'll get this episode up on Sunday as well, mate. So we'll get you all the links on that when it's up. And yeah, dude, and when Killswitch are over in you know, whenever they're over here, if there's a Manchester date, we will come and see you and say hello.
Yeah, oh, that'd definitely.
Be incredible.
Or anywhere in the UK, mate. It's only small. We'll get
there. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. That's the beauty of it. All right, dude. Well, listen, enjoy your Friday night off. Good luck with the upcoming landing of number 3.
I know.
And yeah, man.
Scary
just
times.
Keep being you and keep putting out what you put out into the world, mate. The light and the love that you share is appreciated by many, including myself.
Thank you, boys. Thank you very much. Lovely to see
All
you.
Right, brother.
See you later.
All nice right, one, Andy.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.